Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is episode 18 of about a 20-part podcast series on the history of the Catholic Church. I had planned to cover one century per episode, but we've now got up to the 16th century. In the last episode, episode 17, we covered about half of what we needed to talk about. The 16th century, of course, is the century of the Renaissance popes, the century of the Reformation. You've got such amazing figures during this century, from Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael through to the Renaissance popes, and of course Martin Luther and Henry VIII, and all of the happenings during the Protestant Reformation. Then, in the second half of the 16th century, we have the Catholic Counter-Reformation. So, there's so much to talk about. And in the last episode 17, we split it down and looked at some of the reform movements that were going on in the 15th century, which laid a kind of foundation for what was going to happen in the 16th century. And then we also went through and looked at the popes from the end of the 15th century right through to the beginning of the 16th century, talking about the Renaissance popes and how Pope Alexander VI, for instance, and Leo X and Julius were popes who marched out to war, who had mistresses and had a huge amount of wealth and power, and Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, had apparently 9 children from 3 different women. So the corruption and the power grabbing had crept back into the papacy. Meantime, at the grassroots level, all these different reform movements were going on and kind of setting the ground and laying the foundation for what was going to happen in the Protestant Reformation. So let's pick up the story, therefore, with one of the precursors of the Reformation, who was Savonarola. Savonarola was a Dominican monk in Florence at the end of the 15th century, and he was preaching against the decadence and the sin and the affluence and the wealth and the greed in Florence at that time. Remember, Florence at this time is at the height of its wealth and power with the big great Renaissance families like the Medicis, who were controlling things and were so extraordinarily wealthy. But there was also a time of immorality as well as financial corruption, and Savonarola preached against this, and he especially preached against Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, saying that he was an Antichrist. And so Alexander VI excommunicates Savonarola in 1497. Just 1 year later, the people of Florence turn against Savonarola, and he's tried and burned at the stake as a heretic. And so this was a very grim and a reminder what would happen to heretics at this time period. Remember John Huss in Bohemia, not too long before this, as it was one of the forerunners of the Reformation, was also tried as a heretic and burnt. So Martin Luther comes onto the scene around this time. He's born in 1483. And just a few years after Savonarola is burnt in Florence, Martin Luther in 1505 enters a monastery. He's a very bright but also very morbid and introverted young man. He's trying to serve the Lord. He loves the Lord. He joins the Augustinian order, which is the most extreme religious order, and he tries to please the Lord through his hard work and through his prayers and through his asceticism. But then he has a crisis of faith. But between 1509 and 1513, his academic career continues to grow. He's a linguist, he's a theologian, and he is beginning to study the scriptures in more depth. And by 1514, he finally comes to a personal kind of realization and understanding and enlightenment that salvation is not by works and by striving hard with prayers and asceticism, but it's by accepting God's gift of grace and through faith. And he comes to this through his reading of the book of Romans. And therefore, this becomes the foundation for his whole movement, in which the faith is based on a personal relationship, a personal encounter of the person with God, with Christ, and this begins to upset the entire Catholic system. Now, Martin Luther would probably have been burnt at the stake if it weren't for the political factors that were going on at the same time. And that is that the German princes began to back Martin Luther once they realized the people were on his side. And they saw this as a way to also break the political and economic stranglehold that the Catholic Church had over them. Well, of course, other things are happening at the same time. By 1519, by 1517, Martin Luther goes to the church door in Wittenberg and he nails up his 95 Theses, and this is a challenge to a debate about the question of indulgences, not just indulgences but the sale of indulgences, but the principle of indulgences, that a person could buy their salvation or they could earn their salvation. So Martin Luther's call for reform is not just over practical matters, but it's most importantly over doctrinal matters as well. By 1519 and 1520, he's becoming more extreme in recognizing the Pope as an Antichrist denying the validity of the Catholic sacraments and apostolic succession, and he's on his way now to a real break with Rome. In 1520, the Pope issues a bull against Martin Luther, and this would have been Pope Leo, the bull is Exsurge Domine, and it condemns Luther's heresies. Later that same year, Luther gathers with some friends, and he publicly burns the Pope's bull, which condemns his teachings. He's then put on trial at 1521 in the Diet of Worms, and this is where he makes his famous statement, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Really, it's at that point that the break with Rome becomes unavoidable. Well, remember, the Protestant Reformation is only going to be able to succeed around Europe because it has the support of the different monarchs of Northern Europe and then, of course, of England as well. And so when the monarchs actually support the reformers and support the religious reforms, we get a Reformation that's going to be pretty much unbreakable. And I don't have time to go into all of the details and the political details of the interactions with the different kings and princes and the reformers, but this was happening in Germany, in France, in Switzerland, of course, then in England and Scotland as well. John Calvin is the other major figure in all of this. John Calvin's takes Luther's work and he takes it one step further and forms a systematic theology and works that out. He also is then goes to Switzerland to Geneva, where he attempts to set up a Protestant state according to these theological principles. Meantime, in England, Henry VIII is a firm defender of the Catholic faith right up through the early 16th century. In fact, the Pope gives him the title, the Defender of the Faith, which Interestingly, the monarch of England still claims as one of her titles, Defender of the Faith. This was given to Henry VIII because he wrote a theological treatise against Lutheranism and against the theological reforms of the Protestant reformers. However, as we all know, Henry VIII had a problem with his wives. Catherine of Aragon, the Spanish queen, was his queen and the mother of his daughter Mary Tudor, and however she was unable to produce a male heir for Henry VIII, and therefore Henry VIII wanted a divorce so that he could marry Anne Boleyn. The Pope was unwilling to grant the divorce. And again, the politics are all involved here because the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V of Spain was also the uncle of Catherine of Aragon, and so the Pope did not want to displease Charles V, and by giving his niece giving Henry VIII a divorce from his niece. So Henry VIII, by the 1520s, is becoming more and more impatient, and finally the break from the Catholic Church takes place in England. And Henry VIII and his counselors go through, and they, step by step, they close the monasteries, they strip the churches of their wealth, and Henry VIII basically brings about a cultural revolution in England, which is just extraordinarily, it's monumental. Not only was it a religious reformation and revolution, but it was also a revolution in the entire economic and social structure in England. Basically, medieval England came to an end under Henry VIII, and the monastic system, the parochial system, the parishes, the dioceses, it was all totally broken. And this ushered in, therefore, the tumultuous events for the rest of the 16th century in England. Henry VIII dies in 1547. His young son, Edward VI, who's only a young teenager by this time, inherits the throne, but he only reigns for about 5 years before he dies. And Edward VI had been the only legitimate heir, male heir that Henry VIII had. Edward is followed by Catherine of Aragon's daughter, Mary. And Mary comes to the throne, and she's a Catholic. So she reinstitutes the Catholic faith. Edward VI had been raised by the Protestants, and therefore he moved his father's reform even further towards the Protestant religion. Mary comes in, his half-sister, the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, she reinstitutes Catholicism, and she gets rid of the Protestant bishops, and she brings in Catholic bishops, and she reinstitutes the Mass and restores Catholicism in England. But she dies after only 5 years. And therefore, the kingdom in 1558 goes to her half-sister, the daughter of Anne Boleyn, who is, of course, Elizabeth I. And Elizabeth I comes to the throne in 1558 and reigns for until 1603. So for the second half of the 16th century, Elizabeth is on the throne, and she establishes in England a religion which she wants to be a kind of Catholic form of Protestantism. She is trying to please everybody. And the Elizabethan settlement, as it's called, is a legal provision pretty much where, as long as you were a member of the Church of England and loyal to the Queen, you could believe Catholic beliefs or you could believe Protestant beliefs. They tried not to pin it down so that everybody could stay within the Church of England. Of course, it's during this time period that William Shakespeare is active, and Shakespeare and his family were, Shakespeare's family, we know, were Catholic recusants. The recusants were those Catholics who remained faithful even though the whole church in England converted over to the Protestant faith under Henry VIII and Edward VI, and then mostly under Elizabeth I. Whether Shakespeare himself was a Catholic or not is hotly debated amongst Catholic scholars. The best book on that is by my friend Joseph Pierce, The Quest for Shakespeare. He goes through the evidence for Shakespeare the Catholic and lays the case out pretty well. It's very interesting because there are lots of theories that Shakespeare embedded in his plays coded references to the Catholic faith and the maintenance of the Catholic faith. Because under Elizabeth, England was a police state. Attendance was taken at the Protestant churches. You had to go. You'd be fined if you didn't go. And if you were a Catholic priest, you could be hung, drawn, and quartered. It was a capital crime to say Mass as a Catholic. So we're looking at this tumultuous century of the 16th century where all of this upheaval is going on in England and also in Germany with the Protestant Reformation. At the same time, you've still got the Renaissance popes in Italy who are struggling with all sorts of political intrigues back and forth between the French King Francis and Charles V, the Spanish King, the upheavals in England and in Germany and the German princes and the Reformation. This is also the time period of Michelangelo and Raphael and Shakespeare and Erasmus and St. Thomas More and all of these huge figures who changed history during this momentous century. Well, this is as much time as we can actually give to the Protestant Reformation. We should just mention other famous figures. There's Martin Luther, but then there's Ulrich Zwingli. He's a very extreme Protestant who moves things in the direction much more that we will find in the extreme Protestant Reformation movements. John Calvin, who establishes his theocracy, his religious state in Switzerland, and then his protege who in Scotland, who also establishes the Church of Scotland. Under Calvinist principles. During the same time period then, while all this is going on, we have to also then go back and look at what's happening in Rome and what's happening amongst the popes. The popes who are elected during this during this time period are a mixed bag. Hadrian the VI in 1523 comes to the throne of Peter, and he is a reformer. He's an ascetic person, and he sees the need for reform, but his papacy only lasts for about a year. And he's succeeded by Clement the VII, who was again swinging back to the pattern for Renaissance popes, an aristocrat, a patron of the arts. He got all involved in the politics of the day, and again did not seem to be a great pastor and a great Christian leader. It's under Clement the VII that the Emperor Charles the V finally decides that he's going to march on Rome, and because of the various political intrigues, which I don't have time to go into, he forms together an alliance of some Germans and princes and their armies, and they march on Rome to try to bring about a reformation. And therefore, in 1527, the armies come into Rome and they sack Rome. They're totally undisciplined. Disciplined, and the sack of Rome is described as the armies raping and pillaging and stripping the churches. The Pope Clement took refuge in the castle Sant'Angelo, and he had to pay a ransom. He and the cardinals had to pay ransoms to be able to get free. And it was just a time of total chaos as Rome was sacked. And the sacking of Rome, therefore, woke everybody up to the real need for reform. It was in 1534 that Pope Paul III comes to the throne. And Paul III is a pope almost like Alexander the VI, in as much as he has mistresses, he loves to have parties and extravagant displays in Rome, and he seems to have his head in the sand completely, except he then actually does turn out to be the first pope associated with the Counter-Reformation. So he's pope from 1534 to 1539, and he begins to bring in some of the reforms which had been proposed at the Fifth Lateran Council, which ended in 1517. At that council, which had been established by Leo and Julius, various proposals were put forward, but nothing ever happened. But it was Paul III in 1534, some 20 or so years later, who then begins to put the suggestions into effect. The reform was both that he began to put into effect was both practical, trying to sort out some of the corruption and some of the immorality in the church, but it was also beginning to look at the doctrines that the reformers were proposing. So very carefully, he put together a reform commission in 1537 and began to reform the curia, began to reform the finances, and also began to reform and look at the doctrine of the church. This is going to set the path for the Council of Trent, which is established in 1545. In 1545, the Council of Trent meets, and they begin addressing the doctrinal and theological concerns of the reformers, as well as bringing about a reform of the Mass and bringing about a reform of the curia and a reform of the doctrines and the disciplines of the church. It's also Pope Paul III who appoints Michelangelo to complete St. Peter's, and he picks up, as his last great commission, the accomplishment, the architectural accomplishment of Saint, of the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome. Now, at the same time, we have to continue and look at the popes for the rest of the century. Julius III reverts back in 1550 to being a decadent pope. He has a young boy that he's very fond of, who has the name Innocenzo, innocent. But from all reports, the boy was not innocent at all, and neither was Julius in his relationship with him. He's followed by Paul IV in 1559. Paul IV was another reformer. He was a lion of a man. He was fierce. He was unrelenting and uncompromising in his push for reform. He was also somewhat ascetic and hard. He's followed then by Pope Pius V. Pius V is a very saintly monastic figure who is very prayerful, and he is also a reforming pope who brings about a reform of spirituality and a reform of the church from the heart. It's Pope Pius V, by the way, who is the pope during the Battle of Lepanto. The Muslim forces were about to invade Europe, and the navies were coming on their way, and Pope Pius V called all of Rome, all of Catholic Europe, to pray the rosary to be delivered from the Muslim invasion. The Holy League put together some armies and a navy and sailed out to meet the Muslims, greatly outnumbered, and some fog blew up, which hid their advance, and they won a wonderful victory. Pope Pius V therefore dedicated October 7th, 1571, to Our Lady of Victories, and that feast was then transferred later to Our Lady of the Rosary. So when you hear of a church like Our Lady of the Rosary, which I'm proud to say I'm the pastor of in Greenville, South Carolina, this goes back to the Battle of Lepanto and Our Lady of Victories, which was declared at 1571. By Pope Pius V. Pius V is followed by Gregory XIII, who is another worldly pope, but also still pushes forward the forces of reform. It's Gregory XIII who, in the 16th century, changes the calendar over to the Gregorian calendar, which then began to be adopted eventually by all of Europe. Sixtus V is the pope from 1585 to 1590, right towards the end of the 16th century. He is another austere pope, a pope who had an ascetical monastic mentality, but he was also a great builder, building and restoring many parts of Rome and building up some of the great monuments in Rome. I think what we need to do just before I close this particular episode on the 16th century, and we've gone through these important events very, very quickly. I challenge you, if you're interested, to take some time and do some more reading about this particular century. There's so much to learn, so much to study about Protestantism, about Calvinism, about Lutheranism, about the fascinating events in England during this time period with the Tudors, Henry VIII, and his various offspring, but also one of the most important things about this in the Counter-Reformation is not so much what the popes were doing to bring about reform in the Curia and reform in the doctrine and so forth, and even at the Council of Trent. Instead, the real heart of the Counter-Reformation, which takes place begins to take place in the second half of the 16th century, are the spiritual things that are going on, the different saints the Lord raises up at this time period. And of course, this began earlier in the 15th century, in the end of the 15th century, in the 1490s, with the Oratory of Divine Love in Genoa. This was dedicated to personal spiritual renewal through the practice of devotions and the works of mercy, and the membership of the Oratory of Divine Love was both priestly and lay, and these groups had spread all around Italy. And there was even one within the Curia in 1514. So these reform movements, as I said in the last episode, were beginning at the grassroots level and moving up through the church. Along with the Oratory of Divine Love in Italy were the Theatines, and they also began to promote the observation of more holiness and more sanctity amongst the parish clergy. They insisted on the observance of chastity and poverty, and they tried to increase the education of the clergy, which was at a very low state, by forming seminaries and reforming the parish clergy from the ground up as well. There are other orders as well. The Somaci, founded by Jerome Amaliani in 1532, the Barnabites, and most of all the Jesuits. In 1534, Ignatius Loyola came from Paris to Rome with some of his brothers, and by 1540, the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, had achieved a papal approval, and the Jesuits, the followers of Ignatius Loyola, of course, were going to proved to be one of the great assets to the Counter-Reformation. They're going to be the missionaries. They're going to be the ones who defend the faith. They're going to be the ones who also go out into the New World. Remember, this is the time period when the New World is just being discovered. You remember your history, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Well, this momentous century, 16th century, is of course not only the century when all these other things are happening with the Renaissance popes and the Reformation, but of course the New World is being discovered, and it's the Jesuits who are going to come out to the New World to evangelize, along with the renewal of the Franciscan order. The Capuchins and other Franciscans were also enjoying a renewal within the Franciscan order, and the Franciscan missionaries and the Jesuit missionaries were the ones who came to the New World, to Florida, to California, of course to Central and South America as well, bringing the Catholic faith. There were some other very important figures during this 16th century that brought spiritual renewal to the church. In the Italian church, there was Gian Matteo Ghiberti. He was one of the members of the Oratory of Divine Love and Bishop of Verona. After the sack of Rome, he actually plunged into pastoral reform in his diocese. Again, helped the clergy to become better educated, worked with the poor, built up preaching and monastic communities, and bringing renewal into his own diocese as a holy bishop. Well, the other people that we need to mention during this time period are, after the Council of Trent, of course, is Charles Borromeo. He worked with his uncle Gregory, the Pope Gregory the 13th, and also worked zealously and tirelessly to bring the reform into the church and to bring it down to grassroots level. St. Charles Borromeo, the holy bishop, was enthusiastic, therefore, about renewing parish life and bringing holiness to the parish priests and establishing seminaries and building up the faith there in Italy. Toward the end of the century, I mentioned Pope Sixtus the Fifth. He was another energetic reformer. He was again an ascetic, He was a person who brought in the reinstated the Inquisition to try to stamp out heresy, and he's the one who also began to promote the Jesuits going out to the New World. I had to zoom through all of this in the 16th century, and this was after the last episode, which also had so much happening in it. I want to conclude, like I usually do, with some reflections on the events of this particular century. And I'm kind of amazed by this, because I started this podcast back in the spring of 2018, and I could not have envisioned all the upheavals that our church would go through this particular what's called Summer of Shame, with the the revelation of Cardinal McCarrick's misdoings, and then the report from Pennsylvania on clergy sins and the cover-ups that took place, and all of this continues as I'm recording this in August of 2018. And what this century of the 16th century reminds us of is that, again, as we've been seeing all the way through this series, the church itself suffers from terrible corruption and terrible immorality. The Renaissance popes were a mixed bag. They did such wonderful things in bringing in the arts and architecture and music, and yet they were also such sinners, and their heads were in the sand regarding what was actually happening at the grassroots level in the church, where all these different reform movements were going on. And yet God did not forsake His church. God was working through these reform movements, and even with the terrible division in the church through the Protestant Reformation, which was a sad and terrible break to the unity of Christ's church, which still echoes today and still hurts. At the same time, God was raising up His saints. In addition to the Jesuits and the renewal in the religious orders, we have other saints like Teresa of Avila and Saint John of the Cross, who renew the Carmelite order in Spain and bring this wonderful spirituality into the church. All of these things are happening, and while they were happening, of course, no one realized all the different sort of strands of goodness that were coming together. Maybe in the 16th century, people were upset and calling for reform, and they were bitter, and they were fighting, and there was violence, and there was quarreling. But at the same time, God was working in the midst of that. And I really believe that this is the case now in our summer of 2018. A lot of people are upset about the child abuse, about the cover-ups, about what seems to be corruption, right up to to Pope Francis, perhaps, and into the Curia and into Rome. And at the same time, we must not be blind to the work of the Holy Spirit. God is working around the world in the church, in Africa, in Asia, in Central America, in South America, and I believe too in Europe and in North America. The movements of people at the grassroots level in bringing about the new evangelization, and bringing about apologetics, and bringing about men's movements, and bringing about the new renewal in the religious orders. All of this is happening, and we just need to, while we're upset perhaps about the corruption and the immorality in the church, we must have to also open our eyes to see what God is doing, and to follow that, and to thank Him, and to join in where the Holy Spirit is moving, and do what we can with what we have where we are. I've written about these things on my blog. I hope if you're listening to Triumphs and Tragedies, you'll also go over to my blog, which is dwightlongenecker.com. I try to blog there every day. I also have some other podcasts. If you'd like to help to support this podcast, which is free for everybody and goes out to thousands of people, then you could be a donor subscriber to my blog. It means a monthly donation, and you can learn how to do that on my blog. Just go to subscribe. If you can't manage a monthly donation, you might want to click the yellow donate button, which is on the homepage of the blog on the right hand side, and make a single donation if you'd like to contribute. You don't need to. I'm glad to provide these free of charge, but those who do want to be involved and help with this work are very welcome to do so. Thank you for listening. This has been Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.